United States v. Carrier. Okay. Ms. Gorse?
May it please the Court, my name is Hannah Garst. I represent Frank Carra. This case provides the Court the opportunity to decide two issues of first impression in this circuit, both of which have circuit splits. First, does an individual have a reasonable expectation of privacy in locational information? Specifically, does Mr. Carra have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his IP login history? Second, does the government, through an administrative subpoena, have unlimited access to all non-content information in the hands of a third party pursuant to Smith v. Maryland and United States v. Miller? A warrantless seizure of Mr. Carra's IP login history violated his rights under the Fourth Amendment because he had a reasonable expectation in his location information. The use of an administrative subpoena to collect 73 days of location information violates the Fourth Amendment, both because Mr. Carra had a subjective expectation of privacy, and it's one that society recognizes that a privacy interest in an IP login history is reasonable. Now, he presumed by sending an email, or actually just by merely logging into his email at Microsoft, that he was not communicating to the public his present physical location. There's no question that people have a subjective expectation of privacy in their home, and in this case, the government was able to obtain 114 logins on 73 days.
Now, Microsoft knows Kara's IP address, and Kara has no control over what Microsoft does with that information, right?
He does have no control over what Microsoft...
So if he can't stop Microsoft from using the IP information, how can he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it?
Well, Your Honor, third parties, and parties are capturing so much data in today's day and age. There's so much technology, and we entrust a lot of information to third parties. But I think that the important question in this case is an IP login address, an IP address, does that amount to subscriber information, information that you're voluntarily giving over to, say, Microsoft, but in this case it's really Comcast, the information that you are giving to them versus information that they're capturing? Because as technology increases, they're only going to capture more and more information. And specifically to an IP address, it provides an exact pinpoint location.
Well, yeah, because every website you visit knows your IP address. Every person you connect with over peer-to-peer software knows your IP address. And if he shared his IP address with Microsoft, and IP addresses are shared with third parties all the time, which you're really agreeing that that's true, right? So how can he? I still don't understand how he can have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and how you can make that distinction you're trying to make.
We believe that the way that the IP addresses you almost have to separate it into two separate parts. So even if you look at the administrative subpoenas, one from Microsoft and one from Comcast, the cases seem to suggest that your IP address given to an ISP or internet service provider is that you are giving that information versus a different party who's merely collecting that. Microsoft is not generating that information. They're, by virtue of sending an email or by virtue of you having a smartphone, and that information is being downloaded all the time, you are, in essence, providing an IP address because it does have to go through the internet. Correct. However, that IP address, I think the question in the cases talk about consent. Are you really consenting to give that information to the government that they can use an administrative subpoena with no oversight to figure out where anyone is at any given time, what down to the exact computer or the exact...
But this, like you said, his email was coming from home. But the government didn't specifically ask for information involving his home, right? It was just kind of a coincidence. You know, so what private information about his home did the government learn? Just that he has a computing device there?
Well, they didn't know who Mr. Kara was. They didn't know where he was. So they needed the information of his home in order to figure out who he was. I mean, the only reason we learned about the administrative subpoenas here was because the motion to suppress was quashed by the district court. I mean, the government did, after they served the administrative subpoena on Microsoft, they then went a search warrant on what they've learned, on the email and to Microsoft to get not only the information that they got through the administrative subpoena, but also the contents of the email. But those search warrants are what were suppressed in the district court later because, quite frankly, the government didn't do their due diligence, and they couldn't show that Mr. Kara was actually, that they had enough information to show that the fruits of a crime would actually be revealed through the search. And it was only at that point that the government came forward and said, oh, well, we're not relying on the search warrants anymore. We actually served these administrative subpoenas and got the same information, so we're going to now rely on those instead. There's a lot of talk, too, in the cases about IP address and subscriber information. And if you look at the administrative subpoenas themselves, you can see the difference. And I know that the government talked about this, the temporarily assigned network address. And even though we're not raising a claim under the Stored Communications Act, we believe that it's a reasonable expectation of privacy question. When you look at the difference between the email provider Microsoft and Comcast, you can have a better understanding of that temporarily assigned network address. With Comcast, they give you what's called the dynamically assigned IP address. The dynamically assigned means that they are given a group of IP addresses at any given time that they then give to subscribers. Theoretically, your IP address could change every day, but that's not how it actually happens. You usually get the same one.
Well, does Microsoft or Comcast or do websites share Kara's IP address with online advertisers so they can show ads that are relevant to people in his geographic area? You know, because advertisers seem to know a user's locations or, like, things that a user has searched for, and so that actually shows some tracking of the user's IP address, right?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, I'm not sure how much of that is collected, whether it's just more of like a location or if it's an exact pinpoint location, like on this block, these people have Starbucks every morning, or they order Starbucks gift cards, or they search these websites.
So it could be two things. It could be something related to the geographic location, or it could be something about the content of the email and who the emails were directed toward.
I don't really know, quite frankly. But I think the difference is, are they using the information directly connected to you personally, or is it just a whole bunch of data that is being thrown into a pile and they're using that information to sell to advertisers? I think people know, you know, by merely typing something in on Google and requesting something, the next time you come up, you are getting ads. They are tracking information. Mm-hmm. But the question is, should they be able to track your IP address? Should they then, you send an email.
Well, it's just that if everybody else can do it, then I'm having trouble not understanding why the government couldn't do it and why there's not a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Well, our response would be that for the government to use an administrative subpoena, no judicial oversight, merely by the stroke of a pen, provide an administrative subpoena. Right now, they should only be able to get subscriber information.
Well, isn't that, you know, the like the PIN request that used to be used for telephones, isn't it analogous to that? To get phone numbers, to get phone information, to find out who someone called.
And oh, so PIN register?
Yeah, like the PIN register. I know that's going back in the day quite a while. But, yeah.
In the PIN register's case, and when you're actually dialing a telephone, you are putting in the numbers. You receive a bill, or we used to receive a bill that outlined every number that you called. That was the only data that the telephone company was maintaining, and that was the data that they were collecting, and you had full access to that. That's not the case anymore.
Well, but you knew that. I mean, you could get access, or the government could get access to those numbers that were dialed using the PIN register. And didn't have to get a warrant for that, right?
I believe with the PIN registers, there was some judicial oversight. It wasn't equivalent to the administrative subpoenas where the government are issuing them, or some agency of the government is issuing the administrative subpoena without any oversight. I believe that there was some sort of court order. Could be wrong. Not 100% on that. But I believe that there was some sort of judicial oversight with the PIN registers in the mirror ports. The fact that we feel like is the difference between this case and many of the cases out there where it's talking about IP address and being given a subscriber information to the internet service provider is that Microsoft is an email. It's a free email service that you sign up for. And the question is, are we living in a society today where every time you log on the internet and every time that you even log on to your email, maybe you're not sending or receiving it, does that mean that the government can obtain all that information and basically retrace your steps for the past 30, 60, 90 days, however long that person or that company captured the information? And we would suggest that the government should not be able to do that without a warrant, if that amounts to a search of your information. And the way that the government is using that information is very different than a company having the third party, the company obtaining that data for sales or for reasons why people may be okay with giving that data to a third party, because you want better internet service, you want faster service, you want more pointed searches. That just because they have access to that doesn't mean that the government should have unfettered access to that as well. Unless there's any questions.
Mr. Lee.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Lee. The district court correctly held that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy in the IP address information that was conveyed every time the defendant used the IP address and conveyed it to Microsoft when he accessed the Hotmail service there. As every circuit court considering this issue has found, there is no circuit split regarding there being no reasonable expectation of privacy in IP addresses which are voluntarily conveyed in the process of going online. The defendant chose to use his email address, chose to log in. He chose, and by doing so, he conveyed his IP address, and he had no expectation of privacy in that IP address information later on. The government's use of an administrative subpoena followed the Stored Communications Act. It did not seek any content. It sought the kinds of information that are specifically referenced there, and it was not illegal.
So in terms of PIN registers, I know this was before your time too, but was that under judicial supervision when a PIN register issued, or could the prosecutor just issue that?
Your Honor, from my experience, I know that for when we get historical information about phone records, we can do that through a subpoena. When we want to get information prospectively for how a phone is being used in real time and what phone numbers they're contacting, we get a court order for that. So I think that's the distinction. So I think similarly to this, again, here we were just getting historical information as to what IP addresses were used to log into Microsoft's Hotmail service, similarly to how we would have just used a subpoena to get phone records, both, I think, before and now. And just briefly, I want to address some of the history of the litigation, given what counsel referenced. There was a motion initially to suppress the search warrants. There were search warrants issued that were obtained from magistrate judge to obtain the email content from defendant Kyra's email account. The district court found that there was a material omission in the affidavit there and initially was going to grant the defense motion on that basis. The government then came back and said that we had no intention of using any of the emails derived from the search warrant if the case went to trial. So the district court withdrew her earlier ruling. That's when the defendant then raised the motion to quash the government's obtaining of the IP addresses at issue, which led to this case.
So I just want to try to get a handle on the limitations on the government, if there are any, in this world, as it relates to the internet and IP addresses. People voluntarily communicate their usernames and passwords on a service like Hotmail. Could the DEA compel Microsoft to turn over everyone's username and password without getting a warrant and just using that administrative subpoena?
I think that the Stored Communications Act allows, I think there still has to be, there's supposed to be a basis for which the DEA goes. I think there has to be at least some basis to believe that asking for the information will lead to relevant information to a criminal investigation. The DEA cannot simply ask for every single person's login information across the country. I think it has to be, again, tied to an ongoing investigation.
So if someone was using an online dating app to meet people and then somebody got assaulted, you know, that was in on the app, could the police without a warrant require the dating app to turn over all the IP addresses that had logged on in the past month?
I think
they're
could.
Trying to identify who, what was it.
I think
you
they
know,
could
committed
go.
The assault, and a lot of people use phony names when they're on these dating apps. So,
yes, I'm not sure they could go so broad to ask for every, as long as it's thing tailored to the investigation that's going on. I think they could go back and find, check for, let's say, IP addresses for the people who were in communication with the victim and thus were possible suspects of a criminal offense. I think the statute would allow that to occur. Yes.
And the IP login history, that allows the government to track a person's location as the person moves around the city, whether they log in from home or work or wherever, right?
I don't think it's that specific, Your Honor. My understanding of, in terms of, a lot's changed in the past few years in terms of mobile devices. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that a mobile device, such as a phone or an iPad or things like that, that they are generally assigned an IP address by their internet service provider, and that IP address will stay with them for at least some period of time. So if they're just going uptown or downtown in the course of a day, their IP address will stay the same. So thus, just getting the IP login history will not be able to necessarily track their movements as long as, because it's still the same one IP address. There may be ways.
Where are they tracking it from?
I think what's happening is that the information is going to the internet service provider. They're sending it through to the mobile device. There
by
may
what
be
mean, what, by what means I meant.
It may be something similar to the cell site information. So there may
well,
be
that's
some
more specific then, because the cell towers are.
And that would be perhaps more precise location information, but that's not what is would be covered by the Stored Communications Act. Now, in those cases, that is somewhat different. And in those situations, to get cell site information, generally my office we go to the courts to get an order for that information. But that's something that's beyond what would be covered by the Stored Communications Act and beyond what would be permissible to get from administrative subpoena. So that's where I think it becomes different. The IP address does not necessarily give a precise location for a person. Now, in this case, what happened here is that the defendant logged in using a home account which was tied to his home. So in that case, the government was able to determine or infer pretty reasonably that he was using his home to log in to Hotmail, and that he was using an account at his work to log into Hotmail. That's different, but that still was not able, that not enabled the government to determine his precise movements over the approximately 70 days of information that was received. All the government knew was that he logged in from home on some days, he logged in from a work account on some days, and there were many days where the government had no information whatsoever about his location.
And so you're saying to get to the content, the government would have to do more.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so would that be what you would say would be the limit to the third-party doctrine? Because technology is a part of everybody's everyday life now. And so there's so much that can be revealed in terms of what people do on the Internet.
Yes, Your Honor.
So maybe you could comment on the limits to the government in terms of this kind of inquiry.
Yes, Your Honor. The Stored Communications Act distinguishes between content and what they call subscriber information, including IP addresses, things that are necessary for the workings of the Internet. But just like how in the phone context, people do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the phone numbers they dial, or in the mail context, in the addresses they write on the front of an envelope, they do have an expectation of privacy in the contents of those communications. And again, here, the government only obtained, did not obtain any content. It only obtained basic subscriber information. There is a distinction drawn between content and non-content. In this case, involved only non-content. Unless the court has further questions, the government ends by asking that you...
Well, I did want to ask you about this, the good faith exception. That you didn't raise the argument below, but there's nothing that prevents us from looking at that.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's true the government did not argue good faith in the district court, but it is clear that the agents were relying on the law as it was at the time and had no reason to believe that the Stored Communications Act would be declared unconstitutional.
And then on the supervised release, you're not even trying to defend what the district court judge did. I mean, basically, there was no discussion whatsoever on the supervised release conditions, right?
There was no discussion, Your Honor.
And you talk about the fact that he got the life sentence in the other case, but if something happened in that case, let's say his conviction was set aside or something like that, then these conditions of supervised release would have some relevance, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I guess I don't see why we shouldn't reach that question and send it back on the supervised release terms.
You could send it back. You could also just move to strike that one provision, as you've done in another case. Another option is to just see if this does become a real issue, and then the district court can address it at that time if the defendant ever is subject to conditions of supervised release. The government ends by asking that you affirm the district court's denial of the motion to suppress and affirm the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gorsh?
The third-party doctrine, as it is right now, and one of the reasons why the courts have split is because the way that it has been applied in the past in Smith and Miller really leads to absurd results in the wake of technology as it is today. If you have the same documents and you put some in a third-party storage that's in a locked container or a locked unit versus the same documents in the cloud, the government has access by administrative subpoena to those documents in the cloud, although not the content, but information about those documents, as far as where they came from, what the document name is, who sent you the documents, who worked on the documents, versus those same documents in a storage container, the government has to get a warrant for access to those documents. And again, not even talking about content. But the reason the third-party doctrine needs to be revisited is for exactly situations like this. Now, the government talks about the using the administrative subpoena through the Stored Communications Act, but the provision allowing for the administrative subpoena is merely for what we have termed as subscriber information. And if you look at that information that the user has voluntarily given to them. What you voluntarily give to an app, to a free internet service, is a name, where you initially signed up for the account from, and possibly a zip code. They don't check the information. They don't see if that's your true name. They don't check. Versus an internet service provider, where you provide your name, your address, your billing information, all of that other information, and you know you're getting an IP address from them. So given the context of technology, given how much access the government has to our location information, we believe that this is an important case with an important result. And even though this took place in 2008, we're already at 2016, and this case will be interpreted from now going forward in light of the current technology. So we ask that the court take that into account. And we ask that this court reverse the district court's grant, or the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.